Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, April 23, 2003. We will have a public hearing today on House Bill 5014, which is the Operations Bill for the Department of Education, and House Bill 5015, which is the Grant and Aid Bill for the Department of Education. I'll open the public hearing on both of those bills. And would you like to get us oriented, Ms. Walsh?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I have quite a bit of material in front of you, three large binders. The one with the green cover is the governor's balanced budget with a lot of the detailed technical information about the budget in there. And then the two white binders, there's a binder one of two and two of two. Those are the agency's presentation documents. And I think it's two of two has all the PowerPoint presentations in it. One of two has all kinds of information in it, including things like the vacancy list, span of control, organizational information, federal funds overview, budget notes, audit reports, and things of that nature. And so as we talk about things, we can refer you to which binder you should be looking in. So the plan for today is to have the superintendent of public instruction come up and present some introductory remarks, and then I'll do my brief overview, and then we'll have more detailed presentation by the Department of Education. And then if we have time, we hope to have Budget and Management do its presentation of the governor's balanced budget.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Messerman.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, which one of these binders will show the governor's revised budget, or are there?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we don't have the governor's revised budget in any of this information.
Right.
But we could get that information to you during the hearings for you.
Thank you.
I would assume that Ms. Ames would be a good target for those type of questions.
Get ready, Linda.
And if I could call Superintendent Castillo forward, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Susan Castillo, Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. It is great to be before you today as we start taking a look at our department's budget for the next biennium. We have done a lot of work to prepare for this, and we are ready and are looking forward to the days this week. I am just completing my first 100 days as a Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon, and it has become real clear to me that there is a need to bring together all of the good policy work that is happening in our state by a whole lot of different entities. First of all, the good work of the legislature on education policy, the good work of the Oregon Quality Education Commission, the work of our State Board of Education, the work of the Oregon Business Council, of AOI, and of the Oregon Business Association. We have a lot of good work underway, and all of it really seems to be going in the same direction if you take a look at the policy discussions that are underway in all of those arenas. And that is that we need to continue moving forward on the accomplishments of our rising test scores, and that we do have a lot of work we need to accomplish in the area around closing the achievement gap and in high school reform and middle school improvements. And so in my attempt to bring all of a focus, a united focus on how we all move together on that mission, I have set four priorities for my administration. The first is closing the achievement gap and focusing on that. While we have been making progress in our efforts to create success for every student, we still have a lot of work to do, and I know that you're aware of that. We are refocusing our staff and our work to more aggressively increase the achievement levels of those who have been falling behind in our state. The second priority is making every student in our state a highly proficient reader. We must ensure that all students in grades K through 12 meet or exceed state standards in reading and writing. We have made great progress in the early grades, We're excited about the progress we have made in the early grades, but we need to expand our efforts to focus on all grades, all kids. The third priority is creating more success in middle schools and high schools. We need to create schools that offer a more personalized and connected experience for students, helping every student prepare for their next steps in life, work, college, and good citizenship. Partnership opportunities are what we need to explore and enhance. And I know we've all probably seen the headline in today's Oregonian about the $25 million that is coming to our state to help us with our efforts to improve high schools. The fourth priority is a well-run, efficient, and accountable Department of Education, and I'll talk more about that in just a moment. In the presentations that you will be hearing over the next few days, I would like to direct your attention to two very critical areas in the department, not only to the department's operations, but to our entire state. First, the Oregon State Assessment System. Our state testing system is done by the department and is a high-quality, cost-effective testing system, and our assessment system has been fully approved by the U.S. Department of Education as meeting the requirements of No Child Left Behind. Second area is the Technology and Information Resources Division. Education today is dependent on data gathering and analysis in order to make good funding and policy decisions and to demand accountability. No Child Left Behind requires us to track and report on student achievement as never before. We must track and report on teacher quality, school performance, and a host of other data elements. Technology also offers us a path to cost saving through greater efficiencies. And I want to take a moment to acknowledge that I know that it is no secret that the Department of Education is a state agency in need of improvement. The talented and dedicated employees there acknowledge that more efficiency and focus are needed. One of my first actions as superintendent was to pull together a no-nonsense management team of state government professionals led by Mike Greenfield to take a critical look at the operations of the department. The Department of Education must function as a well-run state agency. My next step was to create a hybrid team of managers and educators. This team is the management core of the department, and the team is critical to managing the rest of the K-12 system. Oregon operates a multi-billion dollar school system, and the state expects and deserves a top-flight management team to direct that system. The team I've assembled is working to get the department back on track, and I'm confident that we have already made progress in my first 100 days. So we have our priorities set. We have a management strategy. We have a budget that is consistent with our priorities and those strategies. One final step is to build and maintain critical partnerships both inside and outside the education community. We are dependent on human services and community resources for student success. We know that our schools cannot do it alone. For example, as we work to reduce the dropout rate, students have given us many reasons for leaving high school, and many of those reasons have little or nothing to do with school. It is a family and community issue in addition to being an educational issue. I am very committed to building the partnerships that will enable us to close the achievement gap, ensure that every student reads and writes at a high level, and that every student graduates ready to move on to their next stage of life. We also know that it's essential that the department provide you and all of Oregon citizens with accurate and credible information about the challenges and the many successes of our public schools. It's important in order for you to have confidence that the department is managing our school fund effectively and that resources are getting to the classroom, not being wasted on administrative overhead. We know that you and all Oregonians need to be assured that our schools and the Department of Education are using our tax dollars in the best way possible to create more success for more kids in our state. And I'd be glad to answer any questions as we get this started today.
Questions or comments for the superintendent? Well, you got off very easily. What I would like to comment on one thing, and that is throughout the time that we've been working together since the beginning of the session, I really want to commend the quality of the communication that we've had. I think that you've made it really clear, and your staff has worked really hard to work with the Legislative Fiscal Office and to work with the people on this committee and the policy end of the education arena to have a really sound dialogue, and I appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your help. You have been very wonderful at helping to advise us and lead the way for how we needed to present this legislative session, so thank you.
Ms. McGlashan, did you wish to give us the overview according to LFO's view of the world?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, I've got a couple of handouts for you today. One is the orientation and background sheet that I think you've probably seen before in one form or another, and I'll briefly go through that. The first item there directs you to an attached handout, which looks like this 2003-05 Governor's Budget for the Oregon Department of Education. And I just point out that in binder one of two, the department has generously provided a tab for the LFO overview, so after we go through it, you can put it in your binder here, and they've done the same for the DAS overview, so you can have everything in one of two places. Yes. So just briefly, to put the budget in some sort of context, I'll go through some of these slides. The first one just talks about, after the introductory slide, just talks about the role and the purpose of the department, and the department will get more into that, so I won't spend a lot of time on that today, but I just wanted to point out that slide to you. And then just to clarify how the department's budget is provided for in legislation, most agencies have one budget bill. This department has three. There's House Bill 5014 and House Bill 5015, which we're hearing about today and for the next several days. House Bill 5014 is for operations, the special schools for the blind and deaf, youth corrections education program, and debt service. And then House Bill 5015 is for the grant and aid programs for the department. And one of the reasons why we're listening to them concurrently is because it's hard to separate the grant and aid programs from what the department does, because they administer those grant and aid programs. And then, of course, there's House Bill 5016, which is for the state school fund, and you previously heard that bill. So we won't be spending any time on that part of it, or very little. And on that slide, you'll see that there's a table in there that shows you the overall budget for the Department of Education, the $6.2 billion, which, of course, includes the state school fund. And what I've done is broken it out by budget unit and then indicated for you which bill the budget is contained in. So, for example, operations, you'll see, is in 5014, and then I show you the different fund sources for the operations budget and the number of FTE. So that's just to kind of orient you to how this budget works and how it relates to the budget bills before you. And then just a couple other things I'd like to point out. If you turn to slide four, you'll see that without the state school fund, the total budget for the Department of Education is $1.14 billion. And I just wanted to point out that about two-thirds of the budget is federal funds. So if you look at that pie chart, you'll see $580 million in federal funds limited, and that's 51% of the budget, and then also $183.3 million non-limited federal funds, and that's for the nutrition program, and that's about 16.1% of the budget. That's about 67% of the total budget. And then if you turn to the next slide, on that slide five, you'll see that total general fund and lottery fund support is $315 million in this budget. And 76% of that general fund goes out as a grant and aid to local programs. And then 100% of the lottery funds is used for debt service on education lottery bonds. And again, we can get into more detail as the hearings progress. But I did want to point out that significant portion of the general fund in this budget goes out to local programs. And then finally, that last graph just points out that as with the general fund, the majority of federal funds also is distributed to local programs as grant and aid, and that's about 94% of the federal funds. And then that last slide just points out some budget drivers and challenges for the department in terms of its budget. And again, as we get more into the hearings, we can talk in greater depth about those. And then the second item on your orientation and background sheet directs you to the LFO analysis of the governor's budget. And I just wanted to point out that that is not available. I'll probably have it to your offices later today or sometime tomorrow. Some additional information came to my attention regarding the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, and that's discussed in the analysis. And I just want to make sure that you have the most accurate and up-to-date information available in that analysis.
So we'll be able to discuss that then at the beginning of tomorrow's meeting.
We can, if you like, Madam Chair, or I can just hand it out to you. The third item there talks about the budget notes from the 2001 session, and this agency had 16 budget notes. There was one that was a duplicate because it was the same budget note in two separate budget reports, but they had 16 budget notes. And in binder one of two, they've got towards the back a tab for those budget notes, and they've provided information on how they've responded to each one of those budget notes. And I would just point out that two of the budget notes pertain to the use of data in developing the state school fund budget. And we briefly talked about those in the state school fund hearings on House Bill 5016. And the next item is on audit reports. And again, they've provided a tab in binder one of two towards the back. It's called audits. And they have in there not only the full audit reports, but they have a summary of each audit and how they've responded to the audit findings. And the last item I would bring to your attention in the overview is a fee adjustment. Senate Bill 126 would increase the fees that they charge for proposals of textbooks and other instructional materials submitted by publishers and suppliers to the State Board of Education. And the current fee is $50 or the retail price, whichever is greater, and this bill would raise the amount to $80 or the retail price, whichever is greater. It was in the Senate Education Committee. It's had a public hearing, and I believe it was scheduled for a work session yesterday. I'm not sure what the outcome was, but I can follow up on that for you. And if you turn that page over, one other thing I'll mention is on the significant policy or oversight issues considered by the emergency board or the interim committees. I'm just referring you to the budget notes, and I just point out that most of those budget notes related to accountability on the department's part for how it uses budgeted funds in specific areas. And we can get into more detail on the budget notes if you like as the department gets into its presentation. I would point out that some of the budget notes related to special purpose appropriations and how the department would use those funds. And due to special session actions, a lot of those special purpose appropriations were eliminated. So the budget notes kind of became a moot point. And with that, Madam Chair and members, that wraps up my overview.
Questions or comments from Ms. McGlashan? Oh, this is really an easy group.
I think we're inundated by the volumes and tons of paper. I think we're a little bit intimidated to ask a question because they'll refer us to something we don't want to look at.
Tab 3.
Tab 3 of Section 69 in Book 50.
Madam Chair. Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Good morning. And good morning. I do have a question about the good news that we all read about in the Oregonian today. That is the $25 million grants to develop Oregon high schools. And I would like to ask our superintendent for, could you put the grant in some context for us in terms of how we're looking at the overall education budget? How should we regard these funds?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley. I think we should look at it as absolutely a useful $25 million that will help us move forward on how we do improve our high schools, and especially how we close the achievement gap and really target and focus on the students who have been falling behind. But I think we all know that if you take a look at the overall K through 12 budget, it is just a fraction, of what is needed to adequately fund our schools. But $25 million is certainly a welcome gift to our schools as they move forward and try to help. And I guess I would say in these very dire times in our schools when people are struggling so much with the current level of funding, having this new money come into this, to the state or coming to our schools really is just a welcome gift, because it will be outside of the regular funding stream. It goes to the Oregon Business Council, and it's going to create a new dynamic on how those decisions for funding those new proposals come forward. And I think it's going to be a really good boost for all of us as we take a look at venturing out in new ways and innovative ways, and then following up and adding on the great work that is underway today on how we move forward and create schools that create more success for kids. So it's a very welcomed gift, but it in no way solves what's happening with our school funding crisis that we're currently in.
I appreciate that response, Madam Chair, and also the added perspective as we move ahead. Thank you.
I think that all of us would be very interested as we move through the budget presentation about just how this money is going to factor into the services that the department's going to offer. So I realize that you probably are at the front end of figuring this out yourselves, but I think that any information that the committee can get about how this is actually going to impact the functioning inside the junior high schools and the high schools would be very interesting to us.
Would you, Madam Chair, would you like some of that information now? I can give you a quick thumbnail if that would
help. If you could, we would appreciate that.
One thing that we need to be...
For the record, if you would.
Sorry, yes. For the record, I am Pat Burke, the Deputy Superintendent for Educational Policy, the Oregon Department of Education. Madam Chair, one thing to keep in mind is the grant is to the Oregon Business Council to be managed by the organization known as E3. The funds are not funds to either to the state or to this agency. There will be an application process over a five-year period. It's a $25 million grant over 5 years, roughly $5 million a year. So in that perspective, it is not a lot of money. It is, however, one of the largest single grants and the largest grant from a private nonprofit to an organization in the state in our history. So we are very, very grateful to both the Gates Foundation and the Meyer Memorial Trust. The funds provide planning and seed money for high schools that are ready to move forward on a reform agenda that focuses on creating smaller, more personal learning environments and focus on the achievement gap and increasing student attendance. Local school districts will apply to E3 and submit plans for funding. The plan is to fund 8 to 10 new high schools. These would be small high schools either created by districts or perhaps as charter schools, but they would be new schools of no more than 400. And then what are called conversion models would be 18 to 20 over the five-year period of those types of schools, which would be more along the lines of academies, school within a school model. There are a variety of very successful high schools in our state that have utilized that model. The intention of both Gates and Meyer Trust is to take what we can identify as a successful practice now and to expand it into functioning schools. Both organizations, I would say, were uncategorical in their belief that it was time to stop planning and task forces and groups talking and wanting to move toward action. And their intent is that these dollars would be used by school districts that are ready to move to an action phase of high school reform. So in a nutshell, that's what it is. I wish the money was ours, just pure and simple, but we will be partnering with E3 in the management of these funds. And again, we are extremely grateful to both Gates and the Meyer Trust for this major step forward by both foundations into the state of Oregon.
Is the program at a point yet where it's known which projects will be moved forward, or is it still? I guess I'm interested in where the process is in actually getting to the point where they're going to do some functional things.
Madam Chair, the process is that the grant is awarded to E3. The first phase is that E3 is to create a small management structure. We will be hiring a grant manager and a small team of what in the grant is known as coaches. These are people that would be working with school districts who will provide application beginning this spring and summer for their plans, local district plans, to create smaller learning environments either as new high schools or as I mentioned, school within a school or academy types of models. There are many examples of that currently in the state, and those examples would be used as pilots and as examples for other districts who might be interested in adopting those types of models. So in terms of the actual timeline, planning grants would be awarded by the fall of 2004, and they're expecting a second round by the winter of 2005, with schools being put into place at the beginning of fall of 2005, the beginning of the 2005-06 school year. So in the 2004-05 school year, as I understand their timeline, they will be receiving applications from local districts, reviewing those applications, assigning coaches, and beginning the comprehensive planning process in the schools that are identified. The funding looks like right now would only support anywhere from 30 to 35 schools over the five-year period of time envisioned in the grant. Now, obviously, one of our interests is taking what can be learned from this major investment and expanding it even further and attaching it to other strategies of the agency to make the funds go even further.
So then is the scope of the grant to do planning and implementation and operation of a certain number of kind of incubators, or I guess what it would be, experiments that have or I guess they would be educational experiments?
Madam Chair, I would say that go beyond experiments. Particularly the Gates Foundation has been involved for about the last 6 years in 38 states, I believe, where they have projects currently in creating smaller high schools or school within a school types of models. The research is fairly clear, Madam Chair, that one of the reasons that students disconnect from high school is a feeling of alienation, not being connected well, being in an impersonal environment. This is particularly true for minority and low-income students who, particularly if there's a cultural barrier or a language barrier, very quickly gets disengaged in large high schools. The theory here is to create smaller environments, either as standalone schools, new schools, or as smaller environments within existing high schools. And there are many examples of this around the country and indeed here in Oregon where this has proven to be a very successful strategy both for keeping kids in school longer and improving the graduation rate and for accelerating student achievement. It's a very simple model, Madam Chair. Students do better when they are known and honored and valued in a school environment, and they do less well when they feel alienated and disconnected from their environment. So these funds are, and it is the intent particularly of the Gates Foundation to try to create these smaller, more personal environments.
So then from a functional point of view, the projects that are selected for funding, will the funding that they receive will be in addition to the basics, the school support funding or any of the other funding that flows through?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Again, it's only about $5 million a year spread throughout the state. And the funds are essentially professional development funds and planning funds for the school staffs to come together for the design work that they would need to do to improve their high school. They would then, at the end of that process, about a year-long process, have a design plan. There would be funds within the grant for moving that plan forward. But as in all grant-funded activities, the objective here would be for more permanent and sustained change, not just change that is dependent upon an external grant source, but true systemic change at the high school level.
So the long-term plan then would be to, once the programs were developed and the staff was trained and the programs became operational, then to integrate them into the everyday operation of the larger school that they were within or whatever was the appropriate structure.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely correct. And we have many examples in Oregon currently where that has been the case. The element of need here is providing the planning time and the opportunity for a staff to come together and to reach agreement on the reform strategy that it would utilize. Once that's done and in place, the normal funding stream remains in place for the high school. So if you are reorganizing within an existing staff structure to create a smaller academy, for example, an example for many high schools that I'm familiar with are ninth grade academies. The transition from middle school to high school is a very critical time, and I'm familiar with several high schools that have created small ninth grade academies where a smaller number of teachers work with the same group of students throughout the day. They restructure their school so that they are more focused on a smaller group of students. That doesn't change the number of staff assigned to the school. So in that sense, it doesn't change the general fund budget allocated to that high school. But the planning for that and the coming together around the strategies, that's what these grant funds will allow other high schools to do.
But can you talk to us then about, well, these entities are supposed to be doing what they're doing anyway. How do they get into a whole other realm of planning and implementing? I mean, how do you stretch people that far?
That, Madam Chair, that is an excellent question, and why grants like this are so important. If you talk with faculty about what are the barriers to really doing the kind of change work and reform work that the superintendent has called for, one of the first things they'll say is we need time. We need to be able to work together. I have a 7-period instructional day, and I have one planning period to correct my papers. When do I have an adequate and clear time to work with my colleagues around the plan? Well, what these grant funds do, particularly for summer activity and for after-school activity, provides the resources for a staff to come together for that type of high-quality planning. Doing that kind of work for an hour and a half or 2 hours on a Monday afternoon at a faculty meeting is not very effective. But particularly when you have the ongoing business of the high school to also take care of. So the supplemental funds, the grant funds, give the school the really irreplaceable tool to pull folks together. Now, the other thing that happens is it allows staff from schools that have made successful transitions to visit and to do exchange work. Teachers have an opportunity to go to other high schools and look at the strategies that are taking place. And the grant will also allow people from other districts to come to Oregon to share their expertise on what's been happening around the country. So what it's doing, Madam Chair, is informing the dialogue and providing an opportunity for the staff to work together on a plan. Clearly, organizational change requires buy-in and support from the people in the building that have to do the change. So their participation in the planning and the community's participation in the planning, all of these grants have an expectation that local communities would participate in this planning activity. And that will lead to a plan that hopefully both staff and community agree to and then move forward with the change. So this is This is the development of the plan and getting ready to implement systemic change at the high school level. Frankly, it seems like a lot of money, but spread out over a five-year period of time over 30 high schools, it's not a huge amount of money, but it seems $25 million is a huge amount of money. But in terms of the overall need, it won't solve all of our problems, but it is a major, major step forward. We're very grateful.
Thank you. I have a much better idea of what is going to take place here now. Representative Smith.
Did you say 30 high schools were targeted?
30. The estimate right now, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we're just now seeing the overall budget. It's not our funding. It's going to E3. But it looks like there's enough money to sustain this work over a five-year period for approximately 30 schools.
Have the 30 high schools been targeted yet?
No. Okay. And it's not that they would be targeted, Representative Smith. They would be based on applications from school districts that want to participate.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Are you ready to?
Is it Mike Greenfield's turn?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'd like to first go to Deputy Superintendent Pat Burke and then Deputy Superintendent Mike Greenfield.
Well, good morning again, Madam Chair, and again for the record, I'm Pat Burke, and I'm the Deputy Superintendent for Education Policy of the Department of Education. It is really a pleasure for me to be back in front of you this morning as we begin our discussion on the goals, budget, and operations of the Department of Education. My role this morning will be to provide an agency overview, particularly around our statutory and strategic objectives and the role of the Department of Education. This agency is entrusted with one of the state's most important missions, the preparation of every child to fully participate in our society and to assist, monitor, and work with local schools and school districts to provide an education of the highest quality for every student. In collaboration with the State Board of Education and the legislature, we establish the curriculum standards that our students are expected to meet, the performance measures of those standards, and we collect information and report publicly on the output of our educational system. We monitor progress and, where necessary, intervene and provide assistance and training for schools and districts to improve. We are the primary source of information and to the legislature, to schools, and to districts, and to the public on the effectiveness and efficiency of the state's educational system. And in this way, we intend and I think do provide accountability for the public's financial investment in its educational system. The agency, as I mentioned in earlier testimony, there's a long history of commitment to children in our state. And November 9th of 1857, the people of the Oregon Territory voiced their commitment to a uniform, common education for all children in the state when they approved the Oregon Constitution. This was 2 years before statehood, and the new Constitution directed the legislature to create a uniform system of common schools in our state. Now, this fundamental commitment to look after the welfare and education of our children has continued throughout our history. As our state grew, our work with local districts to take on a more defined role to monitor expansion and to maintain quality increased. In 1872, Sylvester Simpson became the first state superintendent. And dramatic population changes continued to occur in the time after the Civil War and after the two World Wars. And those changes and the creation of an industrial base in the state created additional changes in the school system. On March 17th, 1951, the Oregon legislature put into law the basics of our current structure by establishing a new state agency, the Oregon Department of Education, and directed the state superintendent of public instruction to work in collaboration with the state board to provide for the educational needs of the state related to, and I quote, the supervision, management, and control of schools, close quote. Rex Putnam was the state superintendent of public instruction at the time. We have consistently set high goals for our education system. We are charged with the responsibility of establishing standards, curriculum, operating procedures, and distribution of financial resources necessary to operate the education system. In 1991, under the leadership of the state's first female superintendent, Norma Paulus, the Oregon Education Act for the 21st Century was adopted by the legislature. Once again, the state committed itself to providing a world-class education for all of its children. And now, 12 years later, under the leadership of the second female and first person of color to occupy the superintendent's office, Susan Castillo, we are prepared to embark on a new chapter in our efforts, as Oregon law requires, to promote academic excellence, to provide rigorous academic standards, to provide opportunities for students to apply what they have learned, and to provide skills and knowledge to support learning throughout our graduates' lives. The law directs us to equip students with the information and skills necessary to pursue their future choices. In the past two decades, the legislature and the Department of Education have responded with courage and creativity to challenges presented when the public and decision makers questioned the outcomes of the Oregon public education system. When the famous report, A Nation at Risk, was published in 1983, we were confronted with the information that our commitment to the inputs of education, that is, the buildings, textbooks, teachers, supplies, and so on, was not leading to the output or results that we wanted, at least when compared to other nations. Our state legislature and the department began a careful, well-developed, and educationally sound process of focusing on what we expected Oregon children to know and be able to do, and to design education plans and strategies to produce those results. We designed and implemented clear and targeted measures of student accomplishment of those standards. We have continually improved this system by establishing what have been recognized as some of the best academic standards in the United States. We couple these standards with clear measures of not only the student's ability to recall and remember facts and processes on tests, but also to apply their knowledge in meaningful ways, to produce writing that is clearly and appropriately written, and to solve complex mathematical problems. In 1997, fully 4 years ahead of what is now a federal requirement, the legislature established the Oregon Report Card to report on the progress of each school in the state. And most recently, we are engaged in implementation of the new federal law that challenges us to be even more accountable for the learning outcomes of our system. This new federal law is known as the No Child Left Behind Act, and it reauthorized the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, first passed under the Johnson administration in 1965.
Madam Chair? Senator Gordley. Thank you. And excuse me for interrupting Dr. Burke, but I would like to go back to the page that shows the history of improvement and would point out that I think we also have the opportunity here to include a couple of other pieces of legislation. There was the Oregon History Bill. That might have been the 1999 session. It was the bill that requires that when Oregon history is taught, it shall be inclusive of the contributions of all of Oregon's people, Indian, African American, Asian, Latino, again, commonly known as the Oregon History Bill. And then there was Senate Bill 103, which was the Multicultural Curriculum and Policy Bill, requiring that every district in the state would have a multicultural curriculum and a multicultural policy related to the curriculum. I think that those two bills are very important, and they are also a part of moving Oregon's system of educating students forward in an inclusive way. And so I would ask you to add those to the list of accomplishments and to our history of improvement.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we would be delighted to add those to the presentations that we make, and certainly agree that they were a major step forward for our state. The federal law provides approximately $400 million annually in supplemental support for innovative programs, services, strategies, and programs that target the needs of students who are poor and who are not proficient in English. These funds also provide resources to school districts for professional development purposes. While the law is certainly controversial in some places, the law is about accountability for improving education for the children who are in most need of assistance, and we embrace that concept. We are attempting to blend these new requirements with the already high standards and assessment data in place in our state. We are fortunate, in fact, that the state is very well positioned to implement many of the requirements of the new law. Our system of standards and measures has already been approved by the U.S. Department of Education, as mentioned by our superintendent. And as I mentioned earlier, the legislature has already established a state report card. As an agency, we have focused much of our technical assistance on helping districts and schools to engage in comprehensive school reform activities and to use data to identify areas for improvement. And the commitment of the legislature and the hard work of our staff as an agency have helped us to maintain high-quality standards and prepared us well, I believe, for what is ahead. There are three major legal and policy frameworks that drive education in the state currently, and we believe that we can blend and target them to achieve the objective of universal academic achievement for our students. The Oregon Education Act for the 21st century provides the basic curriculum and academic standard framework for our students. All students are expected to be able to demonstrate their knowledge and skill and to apply their knowledge in the core academic subjects. The No Child Left Behind Act creates an accountability structure in which all schools are held accountable for meeting the needs of each child in attendance. And the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, now before Congress for reauthorization, lays out clear expectations for full educational service delivery and participation in school activities by students with disabilities. The State Board of Education, in order to meet these huge challenges, approved in the summer of 2002 the strategic objectives that you see here. These objectives incorporate the desired outcomes of the No Child Left Behind Act into the basic expectations for students in our state. We intend that all students will reach high standards, particularly in English, language arts, mathematics, and science. We expect all limited English proficient students to master the English language. We expect all students to be taught by a highly qualified teacher. We expect all of our schools to be safe places that are conducive to learning, free of drugs, alcohol, and violence. And we expect all students to graduate from high school. In January of this year, when our new superintendent was sworn into office, she laid out four very clear priorities that she has restated this morning. She has directed the department to focus on closing the achievement gap and to accelerate learning at every place along the learning continuum, from students not meeting standards to very high-performing students. She has directed us to establish a comprehensive literacy program that focuses on literacy across the entire grade spectrum and expects every student to be highly proficient in reading and writing at all grade levels. She has focused on improving our middle and high schools to make them more personal and more responsive to the individual needs and aspirations of our students. And finally, as I think you will see over the next several days, she has committed us to improvement of agency efficiency and effectiveness, areas that we know we must improve. Part of that effort toward improving efficiency and effectiveness is to attempt to maintain a high level of service while reducing the overall size of the agency. You will be presented with a lot of information over the next several days. A point, however, that I would make here is that, as you can see on this chart, the overall full-time equivalent staff positions in the agency, represented by the pink line, has been reduced by 100 positions since the 1997-99 biennium. At the same time, increases in expectations for system performance have come to the agency, such as the Oregon Report Card, requests for more assessment data, and implementation of the No Child Left Behind Act. We have responded by doing more with less, focusing on our core mission and making much better use of technology. Education is a very significant enterprise in our state. utilizing approximately $5 billion in general fund revenue alone and employing over 50,000 people and serving 540,000 students in 1,250 schools and 198 school districts throughout the state. A very small amount of this total resource is used to manage, monitor, and improve performance in this very large undertaking. Here's another way of looking at this. The set of charts that you see provides a visual overview of the portion of the general fund revenue used in the operation of the Department of Education. Beginning from the left, you see that out of the $5 billion spent on education, the other category is where the three functions of grant and aid funds, special schools, and department operations are located. Further blowing up the chart on the far right, you see that the detail for department operations. As you can see, the amount spent on management of education at the state is a relatively small portion of the overall state investment in education. This investment provides the standard setting, assessment and evaluation, compliance monitoring, and technical assistance functions about which I have been speaking. It goes without saying that to achieve our strategic objectives and organizational priorities I described earlier, as well as to provide the level of information and analysis expected of us, we must continually focus our efforts on focusing on the core mission of the organization. We have provided information for you in your notebooks on the organizational structure of the agency. Since Superintendent Castillo's arrival, we have begun a process of scrutinizing every vacancy and every job function within the organization. The current organizational chart reflects a streamlined agency with a deputy for operations, my colleague Mr. Greenfield, and a deputy for educational policy. We have consolidated the number of associate superintendents and brought them together under a single supervisory structure. We have a long way to go, but we are focused on more disciplined decision-making and working across the agency in a collaborative fashion rather than the organizational silos of the past. A key change has been the increased demands of the No Child Left Behind Act, and we are compelled to assign an increasing number of resources to implement the accountability and monitoring functions contained in the law. In many instances, the federal financial support is mandated to flow through the agency directly to local school districts, and administrative costs are not fully covered by the federal allocation, even though the state agency is required to perform certain functions. The combination of declining state resources with increasing federal requirements means that more people within the agency are assigned specifically to federal work, and fewer people are available for general agency work that is not part of No Child Left Behind. We probably can't emphasize enough the role of the department in the role that the department plays in looking over the dozens of different sources of federal money and the process of knowing what to apply for, how to apply, how to receive the funds, how to distribute the funds, and perhaps most importantly, how to be accountable for the expenditures. The department plays a critical role in maintaining efficient working relationships with the U.S. Department of Education, accounts for the funds, and resolves problems or complaints as they arise. The U.S. Department counts on knowing that knowledgeable people are managing these issues in each state agency. Despite these challenges, the agency's performance continues to be strong. We continue to successfully implement both state and federal initiatives with a very high degree of competence. The publication in January of the latest state report card was as well managed as it has ever been. We are already ahead of some of the requirements of the new federal law and making significant progress with others, including working in a more collaborative way with partners such as the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, the Oregon School Boards Association, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Employees Association, the Department of Human Resources, our education service districts, universities and colleges, teacher standards and practices, and many others. We continue to work effectively with the legislature, with our board, and the public in policy interpretation and development, tackling recently such controversial issues as charter schools, district waiver requests, implications of shortened school years, curriculum and graduation requirements, certificate of initial mastery requirements, and so on. Above all, we have continued to focus on providing clear measures of performance and accountability, such as achievement data reports, the Oregon Report Card, and the Database Initiative. We have opened our work to in-depth analysis by others and are using tools such as the Database Initiative and the Quality Education Model, along with critical friends from outside of the agency, to help us align our work to clear and measurable performance indicators. Work with the Oregon Progress Board, which we recently completed in the first round of looking at agency performance measures linked to Oregon benchmarks. That work has just recently been completed. That work looked at 7 agency goals linked to the superintendent's priorities. In addition, we've looked at issues such as providing highly qualified staff, safe and drug-free schools, our level of customer service, and so on. The agency performance measures, as we continue to work with the benchmarks, will assist us as we move forward to become more accountable and more responsive. But, Madam Chair, I would argue that none of this matters, none of it matters, unless students are learning. That is our bottom line as an agency. We have published in the latest state report card, available on our website, for all Oregon teachers, principals, paraprofessionals, and partners to continue to provide an education through which students achieve at a very high level. We encourage anyone to go to the website and look at that data. Student achievement on state reading and mathematic assessments has improved steadily. In addition, student performance on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, also continues to improve. NAEP is the only national comparison of each state in the United States on a common assessment measure, and Oregon's performance in fourth grade and eighth grade reading, writing, mathematics, and science have continuously improved since 1990 and currently exceeds the averages of both the Western states and the United States as a whole. The most recent dropout rate for Oregon indicates a dropout rate of 4.9%. While I believe strongly that no level of dropping out of school is acceptable, this rate is the lowest it has been in 10 years. Performance of our students on the...
Representative Davis has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The dropout rate, how'd you calculate 4.9%? Is that the number of students leaving the 8th grade and then graduating 4 years later in the 12th grade, or is that year by year?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, the formula is fairly complicated. There is on our website an extensive document that explains the formula. Formula is actually created by the National Center for Educational Statistics and looks at the number of students leaving school in the current year. Then it uses a formula that creates what is called the four-year synthetic score, which is a mathematical interpretation of both students entering the system and students leaving the system, and creates a statistical formula that takes the one-year data and creates a four-year trajectory. So that I could give you a more detailed explanation at a later time of the formula. It is not simply the number of kids who enter at the eighth grade and who leave with a diploma. We experience a great deal of student mobility and transfer. One of the areas that we intend to improve and are making very significant steps forward is as we implement what is known as the Secured Student Identification System, or SSID, we will, for the first time, be able to track each individual student in the state. Currently, we do not have that technology. So it's hard for us to say simply how many kids left a particular school at the eighth grade level, where did they go over the next 4 years, and did they graduate on time. But the number of students dropping out in their senior year was currently down to a 4.9% level.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for a fairly thorough explanation, but I just like to have some raw numbers, cards face up. And I was a school board for 10 years, and we did not have a 4% dropout rate. Sorry.
What was your rate?
We never got the right. The question you're asking, what was my rate? And I asked that same question to my school, and they gave the same answer. We can't track everybody. My estimate was we lost 4 or 5% each year in high school, which put the dropout rate around 20%.
Right.
We could count the number leaving the eighth grade and count the number leaving the 12th grade, but the problem was mobility, movement back and forth. Whether that mobility washed out completely, I don't know. People were coming in, people were going out. But I don't think it was 4.9% for the kids at our high school. I don't think that's a reliable figure for any high school in the state right now.
Neither.
I think it's a much higher rate when you talk about the kids. Overall, how many kids do we actually graduate? And we found out earlier here that people completing their GED within by the age of, I think, 19, I may be incorrect about that, are counted as high school graduates, but I don't understand that either.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, you are correct that the overall number is higher. The synthetic number, that four-year synthetic number in Oregon currently is 15.1%. It is available on the dropout report, which we are required by the legislature to report on an annual basis. It's a fairly extensive document, has that a lot of those data in it. I'll be happy to give that to you. Also, on the report, the state report card document, the booklet that we provided you earlier, there's a fairly extensive section on not only the number of students completing, but the number of students completing with a certificate of initial mastery, and those data are disaggregated by ethnicity on the report card. It's very informative data. You are correct that the high school rate is at a level that should be unacceptable to all of us. It is lower in our state than it has been in a long time, still at an unacceptable level. That's one of the reasons that the superintendent has identified that as one of her three top priorities for the agency.
Does each state figure its dropout rate discreetly, or does this national organization figure all states on the same basis?
Madam Chair, that is an excellent question. We participate or utilize the National Center for Educational Statistics formula because we believe that states should be more comparable. However, the answer to your question is that not all states do use that formula. There are a variety of national comparisons of dropout rates. My experience with them is that they're pretty slippery in terms of common application of a formula across every state. The example that Representative Bates just gave is just one example. Some states consider a general equivalency diploma as a high school diploma. Some do not. Some consider it, frankly, a community college activity and not a high school activity. So in that case, the student in some ways is compelled to, quote, drop out of high school and be counted as a dropout in order to achieve a GED. So there are a variety of implications of how states do that. The closest that we have is this use of the National Center for Educational Statistics formula, the NCES formula. I would like to be able to tell you for certainty how many states are using it. I would have to check that, Madam Chair. It is a large number of states. I just don't recall the exact number using it. That information is in our dropout report.
You talked also about a movement towards being able to track students discreetly with an identification number to deal with the problem of students entering and leaving the system at different times. Is that also a national program? And what is the... I guess what I'm curious about is how soon there'll be any semblance of a database there that'll be useful.
Madam Chair, it's a very, very good question. I am not aware currently of any attempt at a national level to track students on a student-by-student basis. The National Assessment of Educational Progress is currently a sampling technique. That is, it does not test in every school, and it does not test every student. It samples schools of different sizes and localities, and it samples different grade levels and students within those schools. That is the closest that we have, and the information that we get back does not come back to us on a student-by-student basis. It comes back on a school analysis basis. So there really at the national level is no effort to monitor each individual student. We are very excited in Oregon. As the superintendent mentioned earlier, the role of technology, we will be able to, at least within the state, know when a student has moved from one school to another or from one district to another, and their attendance and academic performance, their progress toward the certificate of initial mastery, and so on, will transfer as the student transfers. Currently, there's no common student identifier. Every district has its own system, and they assign a student an identification number, and they can track a student within their system, but it becomes very difficult to do that at the state level. And that's the role of the SSID program. Parts of that are already in place, and we are very excited about the progress that we're making there.
Do you have any timeline in place as to when you'll have a meaningful interaction with all the districts in the state?
We currently collect data from all of the districts in the state using the web. So, all of the information that is in the database initiative, one of the powers of the database initiative is that it reached that level of common understanding or common definition of key elements.
And but is a student ID part of that right now?
It will be. We currently will collect information on individual student performance. We do collect that information on a student-by-student basis currently, and the SSID, which will be fully operational at the end of next year, will be able to move that information as the student transfers.
Thank you.
School districts now, as we utilize the student assessment system, they go online, they're on a secured website, and they can look at every student record. And for example, if there are duplications due to transfer, student registered by one name in one school, registered by another name at a second school, the district can look at that and say, those two records are actually the same student, and they can adjust that on their records, and that adjusts automatically to the state database. All of those types of things are already in place. You'll hear more about that from members of our agency during the next couple of days on the use of technology in these areas.
I notice we have a discussion on assessment coming up tomorrow.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Dr. Burke, while we're on this slide, student performance, I wonder if you could relate what we're looking for in terms of student results back to the strategic objectives for the agency on page 8. There is an objective that reads, all students will be taught by highly qualified teachers. My question is, what changes are needed to ensure that students are taught by highly qualified teachers? For example, what changes are needed in teacher certification standards, if any? And are there performance measures tied to this objective?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, there is a lot to do in this area and a lot going on. We are currently in partnership with Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission in applying the new requirements of the No Child Left Behind Act. That is a very complicated process. I believe Vicki Chamberlain has been before both the House and Senate Education Committees explaining this work. No Child Left Behind Act requires three basic things: that a teacher be fully licensed by the state, that they have the appropriate endorsement of the subject that they are teaching, and that their assignment reflects their license and endorsement. So it's licensure, endorsement, and assignment are the three key elements. And they need to be aligned. And if they are not aligned, that is, a teacher teaching in a content area for which they are not certified or for which they are not endorsed, parents must be notified in a timely fashion by the school district that that teacher does not meet federal standards of being highly qualified for that assignment. Now, Senator Gordley, what that means is the definitions of licensure and endorsement must be clarified. We still have states or teachers teaching on what were called the pre-65 licenses. These were very open-ended licenses that qualified a teacher to both teach or be an administrator or a superintendent, basically with a pre-65 license. You could do just about anything in the state related to education. All the way from that time to the current time, there have been many changes in the licensure and endorsement requirements. Those definitions need to be clarified and approved by Teacher Standards and Practices Commission as the definition of licensure in the state. Ms. Chamberlain is working very hard on that, and we have been engaged in a variety of meetings looking at those definitions. So the answer to your first question, Senator, is yes, there will have to be some changes, and I would highlight particularly the middle school level. We are finding it could be difficult for teachers to meet that three-part requirement of license, endorsement, and assignment, and being fully, highly qualified according to federal law. The answer to your second question is currently no. There are no formal, if you will, performance measures or outcome measures for teacher performance in the state. Every teacher, every contract teacher is required to be evaluated by a licensed administrator at least every 2 years. And that is part of their contract renewal under the new Oregon licensure system. But in terms of a formal measurable number, students have to grow by a certain amount. There is no formal system like that in the state currently.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
What is the timeline for completion of the changes in standards through the TSPC?
Yesterday? Madam Chair, we are, Senator Gordley, we're under a tight timeline to get this done. The application, it's called the state plan for federal funding, must be submitted to the U.S. Office of Education by September 1st. In order for us to meet that deadline, we have to collect data from our school districts currently, once the definition is done, on the degree to which teachers comply or don't comply with that definition of being highly qualified. So we are trying to press the completion of the definition as soon as possible. We anticipate our target currently is to try to have it done by May 1st. I'm not sure we are going to hit that. But we need to collect information from school districts, hopefully before teachers leave for their summer break. So we are trying to have that part done by June 1st, have our plan written over the summer, and submit that by September 1st. And the reason for that target is that that is the trigger for which the state can begin its drawdown of federal funds for the federally funded program. So we are under a tight timeline to get this done.
One additional follow-up, Madam Chair. Are we able to say today, Dr. Burke, what percentage of our existing teachers meet that highly qualified status?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I am not able at the present time, Senator, to give you that number because we have not yet agreed on the definition, so we have not crunched the data. And the other issue is that that part of the importance, and you will hear more about this from others, but part of the importance of maintaining the data infrastructure is that we have work to do to combine databases from the Department of Education and databases at Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to create a combined database so that we can answer your question. Mm-hmm. Currently, it is very difficult. We do it, but some information is reported by school districts to us, and some information is reported to TSPC. We're going to try to put those together. I can't give you a definite number right now.
Okay. And Madam Chair, this may be unfair to ask, but is it possible to guesstimate? And in asking that question, my concern is that there's a great deal of work to be done in this area, given your response. And that suggests that there's also a cost attached.
Yes.
And so I think we need to hear your thoughts about that piece of it.
Yes.
And how that cost will be met.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, it is the expectation under No Child Left Behind that the provision of Title II professional development funds to local school districts represents the one primary funding source for school districts to address any deficiencies that they see. That represents about $25 million. 95% of that must be distributed to local school districts, and that is about a 27% increase over last year. So school districts totally adequate, but school districts do have some funding for the professional development activities to assist teachers in meeting these needs. The numbers are going to vary quite a bit. The numbers in the metropolitan area are going to be relatively low because there tends to be a larger employee applicant pool for vacancies that occur in school districts. So school districts are generally, in many cases, able to find subject matter specialists for positions that they have vacant. I've had a lot of conversation with some of our rural superintendents. This is going to be a serious problem in some parts of the state, particularly in small high schools. I'll give you an example from another state. The state of Alaska currently has 200 high schools of 50 students or smaller, staffed with three teachers. Now, it's obviously a very different state and very spread out. But when you staff a small high school with three staff, you are not going to have a subject matter specialist with a bachelor's or a master's degree in the content area that they teach in each content area that is considered core content. Some of our high schools in Oregon are going to face similar problems where you might have, for example, a teacher with a physics endorsement on a science license teaching a period or two of mathematics for which they don't have a degree or a license or an endorsement in mathematics. Under the federal law, the periods that that teacher teaches outside of their area of endorsement, that teacher is considered not highly qualified for those sections of their teaching assignment. And that will be a problem, Senator, in many of our smaller schools where teachers double up on some of their content areas. In terms of general fund support for the professional development activities, we have very, very limited funds for that. So we're primarily looking at the federal source of Title II funds as the primary area where school districts could address this issue.
And one additional follow-up, Madam Chair. The $25 million in Title II funds, is that inclusive in the $400 million coming to Oregon for No Child Left Behind, or is that on top of?
The $400 million represents the total amount of federal funds that we receive. The actual additional funding coming through No Child Left Behind is really very marginal. We are expecting no more than about a 1.3 to 1.5 cost of living increase in Title I, and expecting either no increases or flat funding in many of the other areas of our federal programs. So even though we did see a bump, Senator, in Title II in the first year of No Child Left Behind, we are not expecting any further increases in that revenue.
It's very helpful. Thank you.
Senator Masterly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I've been reading ahead through the book, and I might have missed part of your presentation. When we had the TSPC before us here a month or two ago, the discussion came up on the quality of education and instruction. And briefly, we talked about staff's ability to inspire and motivate. Is that part of how we're addressing the quality of instruction and education? And how are you dealing with it?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, it's an excellent question. First, let me start my comment first by saying that I am truly proud to be an educator in this state. I think if you look at the achievement results that we have achieved, even taking into consideration the achievement gap that continues to exist, some of you may have heard me say this before, the increase in student achievement from 1996, where 52% of our third graders met reading standards, to last year, where 85% of our third graders met reading standards, was accomplished during a period of time of unprecedented funding cuts at the school level. So one of the things that I think we have to recognize is students achieve because they are taught by teachers who know what they're doing and refuse to give up on their kids. And I'm proud to represent those people in trying to get this work done. Now, the caliber of teaching is, in your question, the ability to inspire and to motivate is where teaching becomes more of an art form than a science. There are certainly areas that can be improved in terms of teacher preparation and how teachers learn to motivate and how teachers learn to inspire. But a lot of that also comes from finding the right people in the first place and having a profession that is attractive to young people who want to make that kind of contribution to our society and to our state, people who want to inspire and who want to challenge and who want to engage kids at that level. So I would say, Senator, it's two parts. It's one, we can improve the level of teacher preparation. One of the areas that actually was in one of the bills mentioned earlier by Senator Gordley and in current regulation being or under development of teacher standards and practices is to ensure that teachers coming out of our teacher training institutions are more culturally competent and are prepared for the diverse classrooms that they will be going into in the state of Oregon. We need to improve in that area. But again, some of that can be taught. And some of it is the art of teaching and creating the conditions under which people who have that motivation are attracted to teaching as a profession. I think we're doing a better job with that. We have a number of career pathway programs in districts and in universities and colleges around the state, identifying people early who have that motivation and assisting them in becoming teachers in our state.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. I guess I'm also, and thank you for a very informative answer, but I'm also interested in how you can measure that. And let me go back a little bit. I've served on corporate bank boards in the past and have been profiled. The whole board has been profiled as to what skills each member of the board has and how they contribute to the good of the company. And I know profiling has got a negative aspect to it, but I really believe that it has tremendous values if you approach it properly with the right attitude. And is that being considered at all in putting people with the right type of class, instructors with the right type of classes and the right age group and those kind of things?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, the answer is yes, but I would not describe it as a statewide uniform practice. Certainly many principals do that. There are, it sounds like you're already familiar, there are a variety of ways of actually going through an interview process, finding the strengths and weaknesses, the interpersonal skills of teachers. Many schools do that. Obviously, it's easier to do in a larger school where you have more flexibility than if I'm in a small school and I have one section of second grade, I may not have a whole lot of choice about how I match up student and teacher. But many schools do that. You also have the issue of parent interest and choice. Many parents say that they would like a certain type of experience for their students. And my experience, most principals try as much as possible to honor that type of interaction with the community. But in terms of a uniform statewide interview protocol where we, say, use the Minnesota multiphasic assessment or other types of instruments, we do not have a statewide practice of doing that.
Madam Chair, if I could just make a brief comment. Thank you. It seems to me it would be valuable to turn down to the university level as we're training these teachers to be able to identify their skills and where they would fit in the education process and really encouraging and motivating those gifted individuals to move into certain categories.
Madam Chair, just reminded by Senator Messerly's question, in both my teacher licensure program, my principal licensure program, and my superintendent licensure program, I did go through that and it actually found out that there were some things about my personality that I needed to pay attention to in terms of how I interacted with groups, and I particularly had to find ways to learn to talk more. you are correct, and it is. I would say, Senator Mesley, it is. I couldn't tell you exactly across all of the programs, but I'm familiar with many of the programs in the state. And some form of personality assessment, strengths and weaknesses, I know in many of the administration programs, that is a common characteristic, putting people through simulations and exercises and clarifying what the strengths and weaknesses are as they go into an administrative setting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Bates.
My questions will be along the same lines. I don't know if Senator Mesley ever served on school board, but I have a sense that he probably did in the questions you just asked, because I have the same experience. And the intangibles about teaching are huge, just huge. And I've seen situations where students responded well to one type of teaching, and the parents would come to me about a teacher and say, we just can't stand him. And we moved the kids to another classroom where other kids had told me they couldn't stand him, and we switched them back and forth, and they all did fine. So there's no way of measuring that I know of, but you're trying to, and I appreciate that. I do have concerns about, and always have had concerns about, endorsement programs. I think you're trying to get a standard you can use that is meaningful as far as outcomes for students are concerned, but I've always wondered that it just isn't hoops for teachers to jump through and doesn't get to the basic problem with which Senator Mesley is trying to get to, and I am, of motivating kids to learn and getting them in classrooms and small enough schools that they can really function in those areas and really learn and not drop out. And I just want to give you a word of caution. I mean, I'm a huge supporter of public education. I think people in the building know that. I believe the last leveling block we've got in our society, and I will do anything I could to support schools, but I also have to be honest about things I'm concerned about from time to time. And I am concerned about the endorsement programs, about the barriers we're putting in for teachers to get their master's degree and get endorsed in certain areas where I'm not sure that's where our emphasis should really be. And I'm thinking more and more that the emphasis should be more in the area that Senator Mesley has suggested, and which I would suggest to you also, that those very difficult, intangible things we have a hard time measuring are, in fact, the most important things. And that looking at those might be something we should start doing. And I understand your department is going under a huge change, which I fully endorse. And I think you might be more receptive to those kind of ideas and that kind of thinking now, other than the usual bureaucratic lay it on them, give them 12 pages of regulations to follow, and I think things will come out in the end just fine, but we don't really know, and we're not going to measure it. I think you're moving away from that, and I appreciate that very much.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I want to second quite loudly what you just said. The implication of No Child Left Behind Act at its core is really quite simple. It is about accountability. So whether or not someone utilizes a particular practice in a classroom, the bottom line is going to be, did children learn? And we can measure that. Did children attend on a regular basis? We can measure that. Was the school safe and appropriate for learning? We can measure that, and we do, and we report it publicly. So the degree to which the next step has to be taken, I believe, is the step that leadership at the building level has to step forward. It is the principal's job to evaluate that teacher, to look at the performance and results of the school, and to make appropriate changes. The legislature, as you know, created a process of continuing licensure and contract status for teachers. And the intent of that was to provide an opportunity for us to evaluate our teachers effectively, to strengthen the skills of those that are effective, and to also be able to identify those that perhaps should not be in our classrooms. Ultimately, what I believe you have to do is monitor that in a classroom at a building level. It is not a bureaucratic task. It is a face-to-face task of being in classrooms on a regular basis and looking at data and saying, are children in this school learning or not? And if they are not, what are we going to do about it? And if you can't contribute to that solution, then we have to make the personnel changes necessary to accomplish our goals. Those things are measurable. And I think that's certainly the direction that we are taking in the agency now.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, I will skip the rest of the data about our performance in the interest of time. The basic information is really quite encouraging. Students are doing well in our state in terms of overall student achievement. But as the superintendent said in her opening remarks, there continues to be an achievement gap in this state. We can measure it. We know where it is. And for the first time in our history, schools next fall are going to have specific measurable targets that they will have to achieve in order to close the achievement gap, not just a rate of growth, but a rate of growth necessary to actually show progress toward closing the achievement gap. They will be held accountable for those numbers, and that is a major and significant change in the way this agency will operate in the coming years. And before turning over to my colleague, Mike Greenfield, I do want to point out two things. We did, Senator Bates, we brought over the formula for calculating the dropout rate in the state, and I have been handed two copies of the dropout report from our website. I'll leave this with the committee if you would like to look at this information on how we calculate those numbers. On the tab in booklet one, under organizational information, you see two pages. The first gives you a quick overview of some of the smaller offices in the agency, and the second shows some of the larger offices or departments, along with the money and the department FTE assigned to each. Well, Mike is going to go into some detail on what we're going to be doing to change that organizational structure and to improve and focus the work of the organization. But that current chart gives you an idea of the organizational structure and where the money is spent. I'd like to point out just a few quick things. The chart combines money that we spend in the department, the flow-through dollars that go out to the districts. Several of our offices act, as I mentioned earlier, as a conduit of funds, a flow-through funds. For instance, you'll see in student services that over $400 million of federal money, the Title I funds and the Child Nutrition Act and other funds, flow directly out to the schools. You have a relatively small number of department people watching over that federal money and the state money that goes along with those programs, like the Oregon Pre-K program. The Special Education Office is another example that looks similar. This is an office that ensures that federal and state funds are distributed properly and ensures that legal requirements are followed, even though the number of people assigned within the department is relatively small. The Office of Professional Technical Education is, again, relatively few department people looking over a significant amount of federal money. Curriculum Instruction and Field Services also dispenses federal money. I mentioned just a moment ago the Title II funds for professional development. Department personnel are responsible for, among other things, updating the curriculum standards in the Curriculum and Instruction Department and working with districts to ensure compliance with those standards. Assessment and evaluation, Madam Chair, you mentioned a moment ago, carries out the mission of accountability and monitoring student achievement in the state, where the Oregon Education Act for the 21st Century and the new accountability requirements contained in No Child Left Behind. What you see is that they're carrying out that mission, I believe, very effectively and at a very low cost to the state in general fund revenue. The Office of Special Schools provides specialized services for the Oregon School for the Deaf and the Oregon School for the Blind. These are residential programs that provide students academic, career, and living skills necessary for them to be successful in our state. So the list, as you can see in both the larger offices and the smaller list on the first page, technology, it plays a key role. We've been talking this morning already about the importance of our information systems and our need to collect and report this vast amount of information and to ensure transferability of that information across the 198 school districts that represent the system within the state. that glue in keeping that information flow is critical to what we do. So when you look at it from this level, this is the point, Madam Chair, that I wanted to make. That's a very quick overview of where the people are. It is a relatively small amount of management investment for a very significant financial enterprise in the state. We hope to provide you a lot of information over the next several days about how that work gets done. So I'll stop there, Madam Chair, and would like to turn things over to my colleague.
Before you switch over, and I don't know whether this is a question for you or for Mr. Greenfield, but as I come to have a greater understanding of the how the education system is financed, I kind of look harder and harder at the federal component of it, because it seems that it is a relatively small proportion of the dollars, but that there's a huge number of strings attached to them that drive a lot of spending that is outside of the federal dollars. And I'm wondering what the department does to assess whether the federal dollars are actually worth the bother that comes along with them.
Madam Chair, it would probably be best answered by saying it probably depends on the day. There are some days when it is an enormous task to comply with the federal government. And I've been at this for close to 30 years now in federal programs. Every time there is a change of administration, the rules seem to change. So it becomes very important to have people who are experienced with federal programs and who have the relationships with the U.S. Department of Education to make the adjustments that are necessary to keep things flowing smoothly. Not surprisingly, the same thing happens at the U.S. Department of Education. There are veterans that have been there through multiple administrations, and then there are new people that come in every time there's a change in the White House. Having said that, I would strongly underscore the importance of maintaining these funding streams. These funds, particularly the funds in No Child Left Behind, are the single primary source of funding that are targeted specifically to children who are poor and for whom English is not their first language by statute. And it has been that way since 1965. So in terms of a funding source that can be targeted to the children who need it the most, those federal dollars are very important to us. But they do come with strings. They do come with the need to monitor and administer them properly. There are a myriad of rules. The No Child Left Behind Act alone is 1,600 pages long. So it is full of, that's just the law, and then each section of the law has its own set of administrative regulations. So it is an enormous task, and we do it with a relatively small number of people. Now, on some of those days, if you'd say, hey, would you like to get out from under this and just send the money back, we might be tempted on some bad days to say that. But we have not seriously considered that at all. These funds are very important to working with the children who need it the most.
What is the process that you have for assessing whether there must be a line at which the regulation, the amount of money is outweighed by the amount of regulation or the constraints that it puts on the process.
Yes.
What's the process within the department to assess where that is?
Madam Chair, that is an excellent question. One of the things that the superintendent directed us to do when she came is to examine our grant procurement process and to make sure that we are not just chasing money, but that are going after funds that only fit within our mission. This requires a great deal of internal discipline, and you'll hear more from Mike about that. When you have, if you have silos within an organization, they become highly competitive and somewhat entrepreneurial, and they will chase funding. There is no shortage of requests for applications and grant-making activities that come out, and somebody will see something and say, we can write a successful grant for that program, and they go after it and work very hard at it. But what that has a tendency to do is multiply the number of things that you now have to manage. And if those things are not related to your core mission, you are sapping the resources of personnel to manage something that is not contributing to your overall effectiveness. So one of the things that we have done is to become more rigorous on what we choose to apply for and what we choose not to apply for. In terms of an actual tipping measure, as you described, Madam Chair, we have not. We don't have that type of approach to it. We don't go through some kind of statistical analysis to determine whether or not to continue the funding. What we do, however, do is look at the results of each of these programs. For example, the single largest contributor is Title I of the No Child Left Behind Act. These are the funds specifically for low-income children. It is a mandatory part of each district's application that they disaggregate their student performance data and include actual measurable student performance targets when they submit their application for those funds, and we then hold them accountable for meeting those targets. So what we're trying to do is align the resource to the core mission of the agency and then to align the work at the district level to that core mission. It's not easy work, but it is, especially in difficult financial times, if you can't reach that kind of organizational alignment, we can't achieve the efficiencies that we need to be successful.
I think in the interest of time, we need to continue moving on, but this is an issue that continues to puzzle me, and I'm real concerned about how you find that balance point, and I know with the maintenance of effort issues that you're facing right now, that this is something that you're trying to grapple with, too.
Yeah, so, Madam Chair, it is a very serious problem. Mike is going to talk a little bit about that. I would say that there are some elements that concern us legally that even that you probably have heard that some states have said, well, we'll just send the money back. We won't do it. We'll send the money back. I have a concern that we might not be able legally to do that quite as cavalierly as some people have said. For example, in the area of special education, students have federally mandated or federally guaranteed rights to services. So we might send the money back, but we would be legally responsible for providing the service anyway. So why would we send the money back under those circumstances? So the balance between outcome and regulatory responsibility is a difficult one to achieve. But we think we can preserve more organizational time for the regulatory responsibilities by being more rigorous about what we choose to go after and not dissipating the energy of the organization by just chasing money. We need to be more focused.
Mr. Reed.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Mike Greenfield. I'm Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction for Operations. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. Let me just briefly comment on the last question that was asked. This is a problem which is much more generic to state government, and it is, from a conceptual perspective, a problem of the requirements that come with money constraining the latitude that elected officials have to spend general fund money, combined with lawsuits which leverage federal regulation and further constrain the ability of elected officials such as yourselves within the general fund component to make decisions. The Staley case was a good example of a settlement which said that if the state wanted to provide a specific kind of service to any client, it had to provide it to every single client in that classification. And so it's well beyond the problem that we have in the Department of Education. And the question you have to ask yourself is, between the constraints that come with the funding and the lawsuits, there must be a balance point at which it just doesn't pencil out anymore because you're forced to spend general fund money in a way that you just don't want to spend it as elected officials, or it starts costing you money. I know Superintendent Castillo is giving some thought to bringing together superintendents in the western states to have this discussion. And I think perhaps what needs to happen is to have some discussion with the federal government about the kinds of constraints which will get us probably at some point to simply saying we don't want the money anymore because our elected officials want to have something to say about how the general funds are spent rather than having it dictated through court cases or regulations that come with the money. And so it's a much broader discussion, and one that when I was at DAS that we tried to make that analysis when we were trying to figure out how to settle court cases in particular. But the point is a very good one, and I don't think we've arrived at this pass as the only state in the union. I think other states probably be interested in having this discussion as well. Well, Pat Burke talked with you about outcome information that illustrates the K-12 system, a success in student achievement. And I, as a caveat, I think we say as a matter of a term of art, K-12, but it's also pre-kindergarten. And that should be the assumption. I'd like to talk to you, without detracting from the points that Pat made, about improving management of the department. I would also note, for additional context, that the shift in funding and accountability triggered by school reform and the assumption of state funding with the passage of Measure 5 has also placed very difficult demands on the department. Having said that, I think it's fair to say that our partners, our employees, and the legislature have been frustrated by the lack of organizational structure and discipline at the department. It is important to note that agency performance problems are symptoms of poor management, not of bad employees or a lack of dedication or hard work. As my colleague Pat Burke illustrated in his comments, the employees of the department deliver many impressive and very useful services. We have already begun to restructure the organization for better performance at the upper management level. 2 years ago, this committee heard from 7 associate superintendents about the operation of the agency. Today, you'll hear from 4 associate superintendents. The positions, for the most part, were federally funded, and the money saved goes down into the programs to do more work. We intend to manage a restructured organization to high performance and meaningful results standards. We will focus on crisp and accountable management of core activities. We will focus on better policymaking information for policymakers such as yourselves. And we will focus on preparing the department to be more of an accountability tool for the legislature, the board, the superintendent, and the federal government. In order to do all of that, we have to answer a basic question. What is the business of the department? Our first step was to complete a review of all of the activities in the department and illustrate them in a notebook. It was really not possible to tell when we arrived 100 days ago what the discrete activities of the agency were. They were accumulated in a fairly random and ad hoc manner, as institutions tend to do. And so our first task was to find out what the heck we were doing. Following that, Superintendent Castillo has appointed an advisory group to review those activities and subject each activity to a business case review process. And I would note that the members of that advisory group are up for your review. And in addition to our friends and partners in the education community, I would point out that we also have Jim Johnson, who's a retired executive, Harvey Matthews with the Associated Oregon Industries, Dick Alexander, who's the past chair of the AOI board, Keith Thompson, a retired executive, and Dick O'Connor from the Oregon Building Congress. And this group is a very dynamic group and I think really represents some of the tough discussions that are going on in the education community.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burke.
Could you go through the rest of the list and tell us the affiliations or background?
Certainly. Be happy to.
Thank you.
Kent Hunsaker is the superintendent of the Bethel School District and is going to ascend and replace Ozzie Rose. I know this is a concept that's foreign to all of us that have been in around this area, but they will replace him in that capacity. Courtney Vanderstack is with the Oregon Education Association. Oscar Moreno Gilson is the Tom McCall Upper School Elementary teacher. Chris Dudley, Oregon School Board Association. Larry Wolf, the Oregon Education Association. Meredith Brodsky is at Western Oregon University at the Teaching Research Center. Linda Bergen is the president of our local union at the department. And Ed Schmidt is the superintendent of the Multnomah County Educational Service District. As so we think we've covered the territory. A business review asks several questions about each activity. How are tasks being done? How do we get the most value to the classroom? What is the most cost-effective way to deliver a service? And how do we get these services coordinated with everything they ought to be coordinated with? So we will ask if an activity needs to be done. Since most duties are imposed by state or the federal government, we probably won't be dropping many from the cohort, but the question needs to be asked. If the group agrees that the activity should be done...
Yes. Greenfield, Representative Bates has a question.
Yes.
Mr. Greenfield, looking at the list up there, and I appreciate the question by Senator Gordley, as always, in dealing with the department, and I appreciate, you understand, you've got to make some changes, and that's a breath of fresh air. The people you're going to interface with that need the help from you are principals and superintendents. And I don't see a lot of principals and superintendents up there saying, this is what would really help us, this is what we want your mission to be, this is where we want you to go. Are you taking input from where I consider where the rubber meets the road, down at the sites, just as was mentioned earlier? Those principals, superintendents, are the ones that really need your help, are looking to you for resources, guidance, best ways to teach kids. I don't see a lot of principals and superintendents in there.
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, we talked to the organizations of those individuals and asked them to send representatives, and this is who they sent. But we certainly do intend to field test and have dialogue outside of this group. My conversation was that I thought the best participants, I agree with you, would be the primary principal people that provide the services, but What if we're going to make real changes in the system, we have to ask the organizations to send folks who can come, participate, and go back. And if you're talking about changing the status quo, that's the toughest thing you can do in government, have the ability to sell that back to the those constituencies. And so I am sympathetic to your comments in the judgment of those organizations that represent those people. These were the right people to have in the room. But we certainly intend to continue to have contacts outside of this process and to field test any conclusions we reach. And hopefully the organizations themselves will be having groups that will be informing the discussion.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your explanation. I'm still a little troubled by the number of or the lack of number of superintendents and principals in there, but the proof of the product will be how it's received by them and what the effect is. So we'll wait and see, and we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Representative Morgan, I'm sorry, Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, my technique is that when we've come up with conclusions, they won't be a surprise to anybody, and we'll have a pretty good idea what the reaction is going to be. But I'm very in tune with your comments.
Thank you. We have, again, I think we're becoming famous for derailing agency presentations, but we've come to the end of our time and haven't yet heard the other half of today's presentation. So I think what we're going to have to do here is just kind of bump the rest of this forward to tomorrow and recognize that we're going to have a hard time getting this done on time. This is an area, I think, that the members of the committee have eagerly been awaiting discussion on, and I don't want to rush it because the reorganization that's going on right now within the department is going to be critical to the direction that the department moves in, and that is what the committee is very interested in knowing about. So with that, and with your permission, I will just simply defer your presentation to tomorrow morning and hope that we can make some adjustments down through the process so that we can get all this good in.
Look forward to it, Madam Chair.
Any closing comments from the committee members?
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley.
I, just following up on Representative Bates' concern about the makeup of the group, I share that concern. I would want to know how this effort interfaces with expertise offered by the Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory, for example, and any other think tank-like groups that are out there that we could draw on.
Chair Morgan, Representative Gordley, I'll have a snappy answer for that tomorrow morning.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, I will adjourn the hearing and close the committee meeting, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.